Of course, we would never do this, but why do so many other people believe propaganda, conspiracy theories, and statements from various influencers that clearly lack any factual backing? How is it possible to fall prey to misinformation so consistently? And what does that have to do with the way in which we learn? And for the instructors out there, the way in which we teach. Welcome to the Catalyst Health, Wellness, and Performance Coaching Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Brad Cooper, co-founder of the Catalyst Coaching Institute. Dr. Lisa Fazio from Vanderbilt University is one of the foremost experts on how people learn new information, both true and unfortunately false, and how to correct errors in people's knowledge. This includes not only how to mitigate the effects of reading false information, but also how to enhance our learning and our memory. If her name sounds familiar, her insights on why propaganda works, even when it seems so obviously to be propaganda, was highlighted in David Epstein's recent writing. The timing of this discussion is impeccable based on all that is happening both worldwide and in our world of health, wellness, and performance. Speaking of which, if you're a coach and you haven't yet registered for the event of the year, the Rocky Mountain Coaching Retreat and Symposium this September in beautiful Estes Park, Colorado, that window is closing. So please get registered immediately before it's too late. They're running out of housing and we want to make sure that everybody gets a chance. If you're not yet a coach, the next opportunity to join us for the MBHWC approved coaching certification is September 10th and 11th. All the details for both of these are available on the website at catalystcoachinginstitute.com, or we're happy to set up a conversation. Just shoot us an email, results@catalystcoachinginstitute.com, and we can set up some time to discuss your questions. Now, it's time to break the code on propaganda, memory, and learning with Dr. Lisa Fazio on the latest episode of the Catalyst Health, Wellness, and Performance Coaching Podcast. Dr. Fazio, this is very exciting. The timing of this could not be better. Thank you for joining us on the Catalyst Health, Wellness, and Performance Coaching Podcast.
Happy to be here.
Let's start with your insights on what's called the illusory truth effect, the way in which repetition increases our likelihood of viewing something as true. If I hear it more, then I think, oh, maybe it is true. Are there places or situations you see this happening most frequently? And can you dig into the definition and where that comes from, maybe out of the gate?
Yeah. So this finding we've known about in cognitive psychology for decades now. If I tell you a fact twice, you're more likely to think that it's true than if you've only heard it once. We typically study this with kind of bland trivia statements like the Minotaur is the one-eyed cyclops, one-eyed monster in Greek mythology. Even among people who know that the one-eyed giant is the cyclops, when they hear about the Minotaur twice, they think it's more likely to be true. So if we ask them on a 6-point scale, definitely false to definitely true, their ratings go up kind of quarter to half a point. If we just ask them, is this true? Some people switch their judgments, now think it's true when they previously thought it was false. And so what was really interesting is that this happens to everyone. It's not something that just happens to some people. We haven't found any real individual differences in how repetition affects beliefs thus far.
And does it matter how certain I am? Like if I know even a numerical thing, I know that 6-minute pace in a 10K is a 37:17. Like I'm dialed into that. Does even that have an effect? If somebody says, you know, it's 38:10, it's 38:10, it's 38:10. I start thinking, well, maybe it's not. Like, or is it just the memory stuff?
It's a little bit of both. So I like to make the point that no matter how many times I tell you otherwise, I'm not going to convince you that your name's not Brad. Like there are some things that are just really resistant to misinformation, but there's a lot of stuff that's in kind of this in-between zone where even if you're pretty sure, if you hear enough other people saying otherwise, you're likely to start doubting yourself.
Wow. I'm just thinking the impact of that right now with the social media algorithms and the bots and everything else. Are there places or situations where you're seeing this maybe a little more frequently?
In general, one of the things we find is that people are much worse at noticing false information, at avoiding misinformation, if they're hurried, if they're thinking about things other than accuracy. So that means that social media can be a particularly dangerous place, because when you're scrolling social media, you're not thinking about accuracy. You're catching up with friends. You're seeing what's going on in the world. You're hearing interesting stories. And it's purposely designed to make you move fast and to not think too deeply about anything that you're reading.
So I want to get into details later of how to fight this, but that sounds like that's one of the tips is, well, but you how do you go about that? Because if I'm in that mode of, oh yeah, I'm just catching up with friends, you're going to have, in quotes, factual stuff come across that you're not tuning into. You're not in that mode. So how do you make that, how do you cross that bridge?
Yeah, it's tough. One thing some of my colleagues have done is just give people simple accuracy prompts. So before they start looking at a bunch of social media posts, having them rate how accurate they think a statement is, or reminding them that accuracy is important and we want to share good information that's reliable. And that does seem to help people kind of keep that goal in mind, and they're a little bit better at determining what they read is true or false. But it's just so hard. Just in general, our brains aren't set up to notice errors in what we read. One thing I'm sure you've noticed doing a podcast is if you go back and look at the transcript, we make all sorts of speech errors when we talk. And listeners just kind of go with the flow. They know what you're meaning to say, right, and they go with it. And our brains do the same thing when we're processing information. So one of my favorite findings is this illusion. Let me ask you a question. How many animals of each kind did Moses take on the ark?
Well, Moses.
See, yep, you were primed, so you caught it.
I probably was. It seems like I may have read that somewhere else. But yeah, I could totally see that. You just gloss over it, think Noah, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's a pair. Interesting. And so is that one of the tricks that oftentimes people will use that know they're giving out deceptive information, is they'll connect deception to a given, if you will?
A little bit. So they're really good at making the deception believable.
Okay.
So it's very hard to convince someone that Jupiter is the smallest planet in the solar system.
Right.
But Jupiter versus Saturn, which one's bigger? Mm. That's something that you can kind of move people on a little bit and confuse them. And so disinformers are good at trying to stick with the truth whenever they can. And then when they do tell a lie, making it believable enough that maybe you won't notice.
So it's one of those truth. It's kind of like they loop you in going, oh yeah, she's got that down. She knows what she's talking about. Oh, wait a minute. I didn't even notice because I believed her on the first four.
Yeah.
Huh. How did you get into this? Like, this is such a fascinating topic. And again, timing for you to be doing this now of all times in the history of, how did this come about?
Yeah, so I've actually been studying how people come to have these false beliefs about the world since 2004.
Wow.
So for a long time now, when I was a college student, I got fascinated in the ways that we can have false memories for events that didn't happen or that happened in a way different than how we remembered them. And we kind of expanded that type of research to instead look at this memory for false information. How do we come to believe statements that aren't true, and what can we do to correct those false beliefs?
So let's run down that rabbit trail for a second, false memories. I just got my thing in the mail to serve on jury duty. And if false memories are as much as I've read they are, what does that do to our court system? If you're on trial for X and the attorney brings someone and says, oh, I know it was for sure Lisa did this, this, and this 2 years ago or whatever. What chance do we have to be fair?
Yeah. So the current research suggests that if you look at people's memories as soon as possible after the event, so next day, next couple of days, right after the event happened, and get a measure of how confident they are in that memory, like, oh, he was on the other side of the street, I'm not really sure, versus like, nope, full on face, I know exactly who it was. When you take that into account, you can rely on eyewitness memory pretty well. You've got that background information. The problem is, if you don't have that initial confidence, well, by the time you've gone to trial, witnesses have retold this story over and over again. And each time they tell it, they get more confident in their responses and more locked into what that story is. So by the time they're on the witness stand, what used to be, oh, he was on like other side of the street, I think this might be who it is 100%, I know this is who it is. So that's one of the things you have to be careful about.
Is there any way to collect those, not collect, to revisit those memories more effectively? I was just thinking, my wife and I were at an event last night, and I am sure I met her at a blood drive when she was helping out, and I just fell in love with her smile. And she says, honey, I was never at a blood drive. It was a job fair or something. And I'm thinking, I was a student. I wouldn't have been. So anyway, I was positive. Now, this is 30 years ago, but I was positive, and she's positive, and she's usually right. So we'll just go with that. But is there any way to revisit that? Or is it like, you know, once it's told too many times, it's locked in?
Yeah. So one of the really interesting things about memory is we sometimes think of it as this videotape that like somewhere in the mind is this videotape of the memory, and I can just go back and replay it. But that's not how it works at all. Every time you're recalling a memory, you're basically laying down a new trace. Mm. You're re-recording it. So you could think of it as a video, but it's one that you've played 10,000 times, and each time you've played it, it's changed slightly. So every time you've retold that memory of how you guys have met, little details change and shift depending on who you're telling it to. Maybe you tried to make it a more entertaining story sometime. And so, yeah, our memories kind of drift away from the actual event that we experienced.
That's crazy. All right. You talk about something called the knowledge neglect. We don't tap into what we already know. Instead, we tap into our gut feel. And I'm going to come back to that phrase in a little bit, too. Can you explain why this happens? What's that all about?
Yeah, it's really just our brains being efficient, kind of conserving resources. We check to see if information coming in is close enough, good enough, not checking absolutely everything we read against everything we already know.
Sure. Too exhausting.
Exactly. If you've ever tried to kind of fact check a short article or really pay attention to whether or not every sentence is true in something, it's hard to do. It takes a lot of mental effort, a lot of concentration. And instead, what we do is read for understanding. And as long as nothing kind of is so blatantly wrong that it knocks us out of that mode, we just kind of keep going.
Again, it seems like with our busy lives, there's such an opportunity for people to take advantage of that, and they are clearly. Let's talk about the gut feel. I have read some research about the gut feel is stronger than we want to. I want to say, you know, it's rational. I need to look at all the, but there's a lot of evidence showing the gut feel is oftentimes very accurate. Can you speak on that? I don't know if that falls into your research at all, but can you speak on that a little bit and maybe how that overlaps into the gut feel that something's not right?
Yeah, so we can think about this in our studies where we have people make truth judgments. And one route they might take to judging if something is true or false is looking through all the information stored in their head. How does this compare to what I already know? And taking this fine, very kind of rational approach to judging the truth of a statement. But what we tend to do instead is just kind of, does this feel true to me? And those feelings of truth are what's affected a lot by repetition, the source of the statement, other variables that may or may not be good cues to truth. But we can't go around in our daily lives constantly doing this slow process of checking. We have to rely on these shortcuts or heuristics, just given how society functions. So part of it is figuring out what are quick things that you can do that will help you determine if something is true or false.
And again, tips to keep those from overloading or over projecting where we're missing the obvious or what should be obvious?
I mean, I think one of the biggest tips I have for people is when you read something that gives you a very strong emotion, that's the time that you should really be slowing down and thinking about whether or not what you're reading is true.
Gotcha.
Because that's another thing that disinformers use quite a bit, is they play on your emotions. And it's either kind of, this is so amazing, this feels so good, or look at this horrible, outrageous thing that you should be really mad about.
Yeah. Yeah.
In both cases, we tend to kind of go with those emotional feelings and be less likely to be thinking about accuracy.
Okay. All right. Any variation that you found in your research that's based on age or educational levels or other female, is there anything you've picked up that, you know, men are more susceptible to this, or someone with a college degree is less susceptible, or any of those types of things that you've noticed, or is it just across the board?
Yeah, so these effects of repetition seem to happen more or less across the board. There might be some individual differences across people, but so far we haven't discovered kind of what those are, or what's making people more or less likely to rely on repetition when they're judging truth. In terms of just kind of determining what's true or false on kind of internet sources, you do see that kind of greater digital media literacy is helpful in doing that. Greater education can be helpful. But it's also not the case that like digital natives or teenagers or college students are automatically good at this in a way that adults aren't. We often think that like kids grew up in this internet age and social media, and so they automatically know how to do all of these things. And that's just not the case. They also need instruction on digital media literacy and how to fact check things and how to determine if this is coming from a reliable source.
So there's no education levels, but you said there was a little bit, keep you from being quite as gullible. There's no wisdom with age, apparently, that keeps you from being as gullible. There are just too many other variables that are involved here.
Yeah, there's some evidence that older adults actually might be a little less susceptible to this repetition effect, at least when they've got prior knowledge that goes against that. And that's partially related to, we think of aging as this process where kind of all of your cognitive abilities decrease, you get a little slower, memory is not quite as good, things like that. But in fact, there's one ability that just keeps increasing with age, and that's the amount of knowledge you have. Mm-hmm. So your vocabulary size and just kind of what you know about the world continues to increase kind of throughout your life. And so some older adults are able to use that greater knowledge to be able to determine what's true or false.
Would part of that be time, the space available in the person's life? So, you know, I'm mid-50s. Suzanne and I both still work quite a few hours, but at some point that'll decrease. So I could take more time to investigate or pause or reflect or think that through. Whereas, you know, when we had three kids that were teenagers and we were both working, it was just like survival phase. I can't look this stuff up.
Yeah, but it also depends what you do with that time.
Okay.
And so what we find is actually older adults sometimes end up getting more kind of tied in to these false networks because they do have more time to kind of be on the site where they're getting a lot of false information. They're in these Facebook groups that post a lot, and they're actually seeing all of the posts because that's what they're doing. Whereas if you're a busy mom of three, maybe you're not on Facebook as often.
Right. That makes sense. Makes good sense. All right. So you've talked about ways to raise our defenses with the queuing beforehand, some prompts about, is this important? Is it accurate? Is there anything else? I just, as I hear you talking about this, it almost feels like we're stuck. Like, I don't know how we can break through this without it being incredibly purposeful about it. Every time I pick my phone, I have a big sign that says accuracy or whatever. Is there anything else that we haven't talked about that could help people or help people help their kids or their students or their friends or whatever?
Yeah, one thing we haven't talked about yet is kind of what are the best ways to do that fact checking if you do want to see, you see this post, made you feel a strong emotion, you want to check to see if it's true. Traditional kind of media literacy would often have you go and try and investigate that source. So maybe you go to the website, see if the website seems critical, things like that. What recent research has shown is that it's actually much more effective to go off of the site and see what other people are saying about it. And in fact, that's what professional fact checkers do. If you give them something to fact check, let's say it's published by an organization that calls themselves the Climate Foundation.
Okay.
They don't go to the Climate Foundation's website and look around it. They go to Wikipedia or other sources and ask, what are they saying about the Climate Foundation? Because that's how you find out that, oh, actually, this is funded by fossil fuel companies, or no, yeah, this is a nonprofit that does really good research on climate change. And you can't figure out that information about the source if you're only looking at their own information.
So it's almost like a Yelp for conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
You don't go to the company's website to find out if they're any good. You go to Yelp or you go to BBB or whatever it might be. And you're kind of saying do the same thing with these potentially questionable statements.
Yeah, just things that you're not sure about, things that you're concerned about. See what other people are saying about it.
Or I would encourage people, even things you're not concerned about, even things that you're like, oh yeah, that's totally true. Well, is it though? Maybe that came from behind.
I used to encourage people that kind of, you see a headline, you're not sure if it's true or false, just throw it into Google, see what Google says. And for some things that works really well, like celebrity deaths. Like you'll either see 10 people all reporting the exact same thing, which means it's probably true, or you'll see absolutely no articles other than the one you're looking at. Pretty good sign it's false. What you have to be careful about, though, is for certain types of searches, disinformers have started kind of working around what the search results are. So if you search for, is the COVID-19 vaccine safe, you'll not only get good information from the CDC, but you'll also get a bunch of information from anti-vaccine groups that are pushing false information there. And so for things like vaccines, climate change, some other kind of very politicized or common narratives where we have a lot of disinformation, Google actually isn't as good of a resource as it should be.
Got it. Speaking of that, you talk about facts and that it seems like, and you've touched on one with the vaccines being part of some big conspiracy or flat earth theories, you know, some of this crazy stuff, that we don't change people's minds by providing facts. So you're sitting around the dinner table with family and somebody throws out something to hear about the conspiracy theories with this or that or whatever. And the facts are right there and you can quote them exactly and that doesn't matter. I'm pulling my hair out as I ask this question. So how is that possible that facts don't matter?
I think part of it is that people have different views on kind of what constitutes truth and evidence and facts. And so for some people right now, even knowing that someone is blatantly lying, if they're doing so to like fight the power, it kind of proves that they're this independent voice that's going to fight for them. And so the lies become part of the message almost. So there's a study that was done looking at kind of what happens if you debunk false things that President Trump said. Mm-hmm. And some participants would buy into the debunking. Yes, I believe you. What he said was wrong. But they still liked him. They were still going to vote for them, for him. Like, there's a quote, he's a liar, but he's my liar. Like, we can ignore the false things he's saying because he's signaling that he cares about us and our goals and moving forward.
Well, and that obviously true on both sides of the party lines, true of even athletes. We talk about, for the sports fans out there, there'll be some, you know, dirty player, if you will, a linebacker or something. Like, he's the biggest jerk. He's terrible. And then he gets traded to your team. He's like, he's our terrible. He's awesome. He's going to take them down. So it's exactly what you're
100%.
saying.
100%. Yes. And I don't want to give the impression that this is something that only happens to Democrats or only happens to Republicans. It is a human thing. But I think that sports metaphor is so great. There's all sorts of really cool psychology around how we remember sports events, depending on whose team we're rooting for, how we interpret the actions of players, if they're on our team versus the other team. Yeah.
No doubt. That's fun. You've written that freedom, in quotes, freedom of speech does not include the right to amplification of speech. What do you mean by that? What does that mean on a practical level? What would you like to see changed out there in the world with all the Twitter things happening right now with Musk and potential changes or not? Walk us through that statement. Freedom of speech does not include the right to amplification of speech.
Yeah. So for me, this is the point that we have freedom of speech. It is protected. That is that the government will not interfere with what you have to say, that you're allowed to say it. The key thing for me is that doesn't mean that you have a right for Twitter to broadcast it to 20 million people. You have a right to say it, but that doesn't mean that this private company is obligated to amplify that to however many thousands or millions of people. And so for me, it is just and proper and good for Twitter to be paying attention to who they're amplifying and what speech they're giving a microphone to, and kicking people off the platform if that's not in line with their goals and ethics.
And on a practical level, how does that happen? Because I get that, like, if you and I are on a panel and we're looking at three accounts, but when you're talking about, I have no idea how many accounts there are on Twitter, but how do they decide, well, this person's wrong on this one statement, so we need to take them completely off? There's just so many different things. Like, me, I'm a big Colorado State University fan. So me saying David Roddy's the greatest player we've ever had, well, that may not be true. That's just Brad's opinion. But at what point does Twitter say, no, we're taking the David Roddy tweet down? Like, how does that work on a practical level? Because I get it. I completely understand what you're saying up here. But then when it comes down to the weeds and what actually should happen, what does that look like in your mind?
Yeah, so most platforms talk about kind of societal impacts in some ways. Going to be dangerous for others? Is it promoting like a health cure that will actually hurt you?
Okay.
Drinking bleach or something like that. Is it dangerous to our democracy? So false information about voting locations is something that kind of everyone agrees should be taken down.
Okay.
Does it incite violence? Things like that. So platforms have these rules on kind of what types of misinformation they're particularly concerned with, and that they'll take a look at. And then beyond that, different platforms have taken different approaches on who do we pay attention to. And I would argue that we should be paying the most attention to the people with the loudest microphones.
And when you say paying attention to, you mean from a screening reviewing process. You basically take everybody with more than whatever, 100,000 followers, and we focus our energy on them. we're not that worried about Brad and Lisa at this point.
That's what I would argue for, that those are the people that have the most influence on your platform and that you should be most concerned if they're spreading dangerous misinformation. Right. For a while, Facebook was doing almost the reverse approach, where large pages with lots of followers got very little scrutiny versus people were getting kicked out even if they only had 50, 100 followers for saying false things. And maybe that's appropriate to still do. But I think most of the energy should be focused on these larger accounts that have the larger influence.
How are you approaching social media? Everyone's got a different strategy. You know, we've had Brad Stolberg and Steve Magnus on recently, and they talk about, you know, maybe once a week, tap in, do some business things on there, catch up with family and that kind of stuff, but generally stay off of it. You've mentioned having kind of a red flag go up about, you know, is this accurate? I'm looking through this. For you personally, what do you do, or what do you encourage those around you to do?
Yeah, so I will admit it. I am a heavy Twitter user.
Okay.
I'm tied into the academic community on Twitter. I enjoy talking to my colleagues, finding out about new research. What I try and be careful on there is making sure I'm following people that I trust, that if they do post something false, it's going to be by accident and they're going to try and correct it if someone points it out to them. So I'm very, I curate my feed quite a bit. So I get rid of people that I don't think are providing good information and make sure I'm only following people that provide accurate information and information that's useful and entertaining to me. Like, there's no point in me spending 20 minutes on the platform and just walking away thinking the world is horrible and everything is awful. So I follow like planetary scientists who will tell me about cool new findings in the universe and people who study big cats and their behavior and a variety of things, so that even if something's horrible going on in one community, it's not affecting my whole ecosystem.
Well, and I like how you said you're screening it as you go. It's not, I'm following Lisa now, so I'm following her forever. You follow Lisa, and then when she says a couple things that have no evidence, there's no backing to them, she's just throwing out stupid stuff, then you go, okay, I don't need to tap into that anymore. And it's almost like the market's response, if we'll take that opportunity, we don't shop anymore at we don't go to a restaurant where they don't treat you well. You don't go to a grocery store that's always out of food. Same thing with Twitter. We need to filter that out and not just go on autopilot all the time.
100%. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, good. Related topic. You've done research on how students learn, how to enhance that learning. Help us out here. Hopefully we're all students. That's why people are listening to this podcast. They're wanting to learn. We've got students learn. We've got instructors listening. How can you help us learn better, retain better, enhance the memory? And then for the instructors, are there things we can do to help our students with that process?
Like you said, a lot of my research is this, how do we learn false stuff? How do we correct it? But I also have this large line of research on, given what we know about cognition and memory, how should we be learning and teaching? And I'd say the biggest takeaway from that, it's actually this quote from Daniel Willingham that I really like, that basically, you remember what you think about. So actively thinking about something is going to help you remember it way better than just going through the motions and doing it on autopilot. One of the ways we can show that is through something that we call retrieval practice. So quizzing and trying to retrieve information from memory is one of the best ways to improve what you're remembering. So when you compare students who just kind of read the textbook multiple times to students who read the textbook, try and remember everything they just read, and then maybe look to see what they got correct or not, they might do equivalent immediately on a test. A few days, a week later, the students who've done that retrieval are going to remember way more of the information.
And then combining that with other things. We had Dr. Broussard on recently talking about sleep and memory and the way students can incorporate that. So thinking about enhances the remembering, and then the practice quizzing also enhances that. Have you looked at anything around the more rested you are? And now I'm going to cross back over into our old topic. The less rested I am I more likely to fall for the conspiracy theories?
I don't know of any research directly on that, but my suspicion would be yes.
Yeah,
that when you're tired, when you don't have your full attention span, you're going to be even more likely to not notice the false information in what you're reading.
There's your next study.
Yeah.
Forget age and education levels. We want to find out sleep hours. Okay, more about learning. This is awesome. This is super helpful. What else is out there about helping us learn and retain things?
Yeah, so you're spot on with sleep. Not only because sleep helps us be rested and our brains function better, but also there's evidence that sleep helps to consolidate our memories and basically make them more permanent. So if you learn something and then sleep for a few hours versus learning something and not sleeping, you're going to better remember the things that you kind of experienced before sleeping. And there's some evidence that kind of during sleep, our brains kind of going through that information again and laying down stronger pathways that'll make it easier to remember later. Another thing we've got good evidence for is kind of variation in learning can help. So it's easiest to see in math classrooms. If you're learning how to find the area of a square, a circle, and a triangle, a lot of math textbooks will have you learn about the square, practice a bunch of problems on that. Then you learn about the triangle, practice a bunch of problems on that. Then you learn about the circle, practice a bunch of problems there. And that works in the short term. But after a while, you forget, what do I do for the circle versus the square? You get them confused. Whereas if you force students to kind of vary their practice, so they do a triangle problem, then a circle problem, then a square problem. It's more difficult in the moment. It feels harder. Students don't like it because it's more difficult. But a week later, they're going to be much better able to remember that information and apply it.
That's really interesting. So as you were talking about that, two things came to mind. Some universities do a block schedule one time a year or in a quarterly system where you only have one class. It's compressed into maybe 3-4 weeks. And the idea is you'll be fully focused on that. So that's question A. I don't want to lose the second one. So the second piece is the student who says, well, you know, I'm going to major in whatever, let's say accounting. So I'm going to take all my liberal arts classes first. I'm going to take that required science class. And then on this semester, I'm going to take all my accounting classes or all my, and you're saying, well, it may feel better in the short run, but long term, you're probably better off taking that history class with the accounting class if you want to really retain this stuff.
Exactly. So if you're taking 3 accounting classes that same semester, there will be synergy between the 3 and it'll feel good. You'll be able to use your knowledge from one to the other. You'll probably do better in the courses. But I would argue that, yeah, 6 months later, you're going to forget the stuff much more quickly than if you took one course one semester, the next course the next semester. Because what that's forcing you to do is when you take that second course, you have to remember back to the information in the first course. And you're kind of laying that foundation much more strongly than taking them all at the same time and not having to do that kind of active retrieval.
That's really interesting. So you're connecting a whole bunch of dots for me here. One of my personal patterns is having 3 different books going at the same time that are completely different. Usually one from before I was born. I was born in 1966. So something, it could be from the 1300, but it could also be from the 1950s or something. One off the recent bestseller list, and then one kind of wild card. And I'll kind of go through them based on the mood of the day. So this morning I was more in the mood for a book by Charles Mann that I'm reading right now. Tomorrow might be Dante's Inferno, et cetera, et cetera. And then that ties into David Epstein's concept of range. Since you were interviewed by David, I don't know if you've read his book, but fascinating book on the value of this range of knowledge versus the constant focus on just one specific, kind of the Malcolm Gladwell spin on 10,000 hours. Can you talk that out a little bit, either with the book piece or the range piece or some related concepts that this might bring up from your research?
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're doing in some ways is interleaving that practice. You're switching things up.
I just do it because of my mood. I don't have a, I wasn't like, well, I'm going to do this to remember more. It was just like, sometimes I'm not in the mood for this style. So I'm going to, so yeah, keep going. Sorry.
No, 100%. And one of the things you're also doing is spacing out your reading of a given book. So rather than reading one book in a week, it probably takes you a few weeks and months to get through a single book. One of the other things that's really beneficial to memory that we haven't talked about yet is that spacing. So having space in between sessions makes the memory much more durable. And so that gets back to this idea of kind of block classes where you just do the one class for 3 weeks, 4 weeks. And there's been some research comparing kind of summer versions of a class where the semester might be condensed into kind of 4 weeks to the semester long 12 or 14 week version. And students show better long-term memory for the course content when it's spread out across the course of a semester. They might do equivalent on that final exam right at the end of the course. They're doing just as well, but 4 months, 6 months later, they're not going to remember it as well.
Interesting. That is very fascinating. All right, last question I've got for you, unless we create another rabbit trail here. What's some of the research you're working on currently that, or very recently, that might surprise or be of interest to our listeners? Something where people go, oh my gosh, really? And it doesn't have to be in this area of learning or propaganda, deciphering, just anything comes to mind where you're like, well, there's this really interesting thing.
One of the things we're working on now that I think is pretty interesting is, instead of taking a reactive approach to misinformation and correcting it once people have already learned the false information, what can we do to pre-bunk it or prevent belief in the first place? So how can we set up people to know these are the techniques that disinformers use, this is what you should be on the alert for, or these are the types of topics or themes that you'll often see misinformation about, so maybe you should be on the alert for that. And looking at how we can create a society and a culture that prevents the belief in the first place, rather than always having to react after people have been exposed to false stuff.
That's interesting. So almost, again, if we put you in charge of Twitter or Facebook or any of these, maybe a color coding of topics. So anything that pops up under this topic, that's instantly an orange or a pink or a blue or whatever. Is that the type of thing, some kind of a trigger to go, well, this was about Jeeps and this was about hiking and this was about puppies, but this one, just take a closer look.
That's an interesting idea. And I hadn't actually thought of kind of color coding it that way, but that's exactly what we're thinking of. So before a recent election, Twitter actually kind of blasted everyone with a notice that, like, hey, US election is coming up. You'll likely see false claims about voter fraud. Here's what you should pay attention for.
Right, I remember that.
And that's the type of messaging we're hoping to get across. So in this midterm election, I can guarantee there will be a false story about ballots being found by a river. In the past 20 years, every time there's an election, that's one of the false things that comes up. And so when you see that story, you should be skeptical of it. Perhaps it's actually true this time, but more likely it's just a repeat of this theme that keeps coming up.
And I think I remember you mentioning the repeat theme with hurricanes or tornadoes or something too. What's up with that story?
Yeah. So there's a picture that goes viral after almost every hurricane that's of a shark swimming in a flooded freeway. It's always like, oh my gosh, look at how much water there was, how much flooding there was. There was a shark on the highway. And it's just a photoshopped image of a shark on a flooded highway. And it's a good example of these types of repeated images, repeated themes that just keep coming up that we should be better at kind of blocking off.
But since social media, the goal is clicks, the goal is hearts, the goal is likes, the goal is thumbs ups, those pictures will continue to reappear. Is there a solution like an auto dating or a tracking system, something that could work with that?
Yeah. So there are systems to keep track of kind of photo metadata and where was this photo first posted. And just like you'll now sometimes see news articles that when they're reposted, some organizations are adding a header like this was originally from August 2019.
Yeah.
There's no reason our photos can't have that same thing. And it also will help with some of this misinformation we've seen around Ukraine, where people post video game footage or photos from former wars as if it's what's happening right. Again, I think there are things that platforms can be doing to better label that type of false images and misleading use of images.
Got it. Dr. Fazio, this is so interesting. Thanks for joining us. This is, we'll probably need to revisit this in a couple of years and get the updates because you've got a lot of things going on, but really, really appreciate this. So timely, and we appreciate you taking the time.
Happy to be here. That was a great conversation.
As soon as I learned about the work Dr. Fazio is doing, I immediately reached out to her to see if she'd be willing to join us. It is so aligned with our evidence-based focus within the Catalyst community. Thank you so much, Dr. Fazio. And thanks to you for tuning into the number one podcast for health and wellness coaching. If you haven't yet tapped into what's called the Catalyst 5, those are our 5 weekly brief tips and tricks to improve both our personal and our professional pursuits. There's a link to access them in the description of the podcast. It's completely free and without exaggeration, potentially life-changing highlights every single Tuesday morning. Next week's episode features Dr. Trish Jackman, who will take us down an unexpected path. If you think you know goal setting, you'll think again after hearing this discussion about a completely different way, and in many cases, a more effective way to address goals. As always, feel free to reach out to us with any questions about your current or future coaching career, results@catalystcoachinginstitute.com, or you can tap into additional health, wellness, and performance resources on the website, catalystcoachinginstitute.com. Now, it's time to be a catalyst. This is Dr. Brad Cooper of the Catalyst Coaching Institute. I'll speak with you soon on another episode of the Catalyst Health, Wellness, and Performance Coaching Podcast, or maybe over on the YouTube coaching channel.